Morning. The one thing, not the thing, but one of the things about Christianity is true about life in general is that none of us lives our life in isolation. There is this invariable connection that is made with other people. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're a Christian or not. The fact that we are all living on this earth and the fact that we all have some of the same desires and some of the same difficulties and some of the same problems, you know, we try and help one another. And so what we've been doing is, as has been mentioned, is that there have been some suggestions made as to what we should study, and that's one that's true of the subject this morning, that it was requested that we talk about some of these things. And, you know, as the title suggests, there's a connection. You know, there's an individual connection that we have with ourselves, the choice that we make about modesty and about what that means to us and how we apply what the Bible says. I'd have to decide to do that. But then it also talks about the relation I have with someone else, because I can affect someone else. And so I can be a stumbling block. You know, that's one of the things that maybe we miss sometimes, is that Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 8, in 1 Corinthians 10, in Romans 14. Jesus talks about it in dealing with his own disciples and talking about how we can affect other disciples in Matthew 18, among other places. So it's something that has to be considered. And then finally, the overarching concern is that of my relationship with God. Thus, we will end up talking about holiness. And it is our desire in any subject that we investigate, in anything that we talk about, that we're trying to help each other go to heaven. It's not an attempt to rule over anybody else's conscience. That's not the point. But it is to help. And it is to help us understand one another and understand what God has said. So we start with 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. And Paul says, likewise, and he has just finished talking about men and that he desired that men would pray, lifting up holy hands in every place. So he says, likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments. He uses three words here that are essential for us to understand. The first one is the word proper. Some of your versions may use the word modest. I know the American Standard Version uses the word modest instead of proper, but it comes from the same word. And it means that which is well arranged, that is seemly or modest, of a man living with decorum, a well-ordered life. Now that is included in 1 Timothy 3 in the characteristics that a bishop ought to possess. It describes one who disciplines himself and who may thus be regarded as genuinely moral and respectable. This term, proper, infers that there is such a thing as improper clothing, not of dress and demeanor only, but as Trench suggests, of the inner life as well. Then he uses the word modestly. The old word that is in the King James Version and the American Standard Version is the word shamefastness. And this refers to a sense of shame. And it seems as though in our culture, but not just in ours, but in other cultures, and we go back to the first century and see the same kind of thing, that this is one of the things that we've lost. There doesn't seem to be a sense of shame any longer, either in what we wear or what we do or what we say. It's just kind of whatever happens, happens. Whatever comes out of my mouth, fine. Whatever I want to do, I'm going to do it. Regardless, we've lost it. A sense of shame. Modesty is that is rooted in character. It is a sense of honor that prevents one from doing something indecent. It is the modesty in the heart that precedes and prevents a shameful act. This infers, of course, that there is clothing that is immodest or that is worn because a person does not have a sense of inward modesty. It also has to do with having regard for others, to consider other people and what the effect might have on them. And then finally, he uses the word discreetly, or the word sobriety. It means soundness of mind, self-control, sound judgment. Such discretion would prevent a person from wearing what is designed to be sexy, revealing, eye-catching, hot, and provocative. Such discretion is the inner self-government that would hinder the temptation to overstep the limits of womanly or manly reserve. Three words that we need to be thinking about. As children of God, there is this motivation that we must have, that we want to learn everything that God has said on any subject. As new creatures in Christ Jesus, that should be our goal. Because we live in a world that can be very immodest, surrounded by a culture that really does not have or has lost a sense of modesty. There is an author, her name is Wendy Shallot, who wrote a book called A Return to Modesty. And she noted that we live in a culture and a time when modesty is outright under attack. Now, this is somebody, she's not a Christian, she doesn't speak from the same perspective that we would speak from, but this is her observation of what she has seen in our culture. Some Christians are tempted to dress immodestly because they don't care. Others might dress immodestly not because they intend to be evil, but because they are simply following modern trends and have been careless in conforming to the world. So Paul says in Romans 12, he says that we should not be conformed to this world. That has to be an overriding concern for us. And one of the questions that you would ask yourself in either what you wear or what you do, by doing this, is, am I conforming to the culture? Because, folks, we are at war. This is a cultural war that is not going to end until we get to heaven. It's something that we're going to face every day. We have come out of the world, and we should have the attitude seeking just to find out what pleases God. In Ephesians 5 and following, Paul says, "For you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth." Now, that's where we should be going. Trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Do not participate in the unfruitful works or deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. We live in a world, unless we've figured it out, can't figure it out, I will tell you, that is has a problem with lust. And it's getting worse. The appeal in commercials, movies, television shows is to this very thing. That's where the advertisers go. And they know what it does. That's why, I mean, they've done their homework. They know what affects people. And so they're appealing to that. This should be obvious to us. And this should be one of the things that we guard against with our children about what they are exposed to. In 1 John 2, what John reminds us of is that all that is in the world, whether the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, or the vainglory of life, is not from the Father, and it will pass away. These are the things that are of the world. These are the things that we guard against. These are the things that, in a worldly sense, that cause us to look at things from a worldly perspective. In 1 Peter 4, verses 2 and 3, Peter talks about having pursued a course of sensuality Is that what we are doing in this world? In Galatians 5 and verse 19 and following, Paul talks about the works or the deeds of the flesh, which is the opposite of what he talks about next as far as the fruit of the Spirit. We are at war. And we will continue to be at war. The problem that the world has with lust is that it is completely out of control. Completely out of control. The world we are enticed by the world towards fleshly desires and by sensuality. That is the appeal. That's our world. We also need to understand that the gospel can change lives. And so when we encounter things in the gospel that seems to run counter to what I think or that I want to do, keep in mind that the gospel comes from God. God is the one that has spoken. God is the one that has decided. God is the one that tells us not to be drawn in by the things of this world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the vainglory of life. When we talk about modesty, there are some people that would say that this particular topic might turn some people off, might cause people not to want to be a Christian. But if you stop and think about it, the gospel falls to be successful, falls and incorporated into our being, falls on good and honest hearts. That's the kind of heart we're supposed to have. A good and honest heart. So whatever the gospel says, wherever it leads us, if our heart is like that, then we're going to be receptive to that. Romans 1 and verse 16, Paul says that the gospel is the power of God to salvation. The gospel is this power. And even in, if you go back and look at the cultural times in which these writers lived, even in a moral city like Corinth, the gospel message contained definite moral standards that they had. And yet what God said in Acts chapter 18 is that when He was sending Paul, He said, I have much people in that city. He knew that there were hearts that could be persuaded and that could be turned to Him. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verses 9 through 11, Paul gives us kind of a catalog of sins and the catalog of the way people lived before they became a Christian. And he says to them, he says, but you were washed, you were cleansed, you were sanctified. In other words, you changed. In other words, you let the gospel have free course in your heart and in your lives. And that's what we have to do. And they were living in a city that was fraught with idolatry. They had temples to gods, sensual gods. They performed acts of indecency and fornication and sensuality in front of the temples of these gods. That's the culture in which they lived. And yet, the gospel changed lives. They were once like that. But yet there was this desire they had to do what was right. There are men and women in our culture who are tired of feeling inadequate and who are tired of feeling unattractive because they don't conform to the sensuousness that our culture is trying to drive us to. It's discouraging. In Acts chapter 17, when Paul saw all the idols, he was provoked. It bothered him. When we see the idols of this world, it should provoke us and would bother us. It's like Lot over in 2 Peter 2 and verse 7, that his soul, the old version says his soul was vexed, or it is tormented, seeing all this evil. Is your soul vexed? Is it tormented seeing the evil that we have to look at? Are you not tired of seeing all that? Do we need to do something about it?
Lot was exposed to that. He was oppressed. And yet he is referred to as righteous love. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, Jesus makes a statement about looking on a woman to lust after her. He says that a man has committed adultery already with her in his heart. So you see, it can destroy our relationship with each other. It can destroy our relationship with God. James talks about in James chapter 4 and verse 1, that there are pleasures that war in our members, and we have to learn to fight against that. We're at war. In a research, in her book, A Return to Modesty, the author was fascinated to discover how many secular women are returning to modesty because they found, simply as a practical matter, that immodesty was not working for them. Now, these are people in the world. They're not Christians. They've abandoned that. The irony is that they've abandoned it. And sometimes there are Christians that are embracing it. And it should not be. We should look at it differently. Job chapter 31 and verse 1, Job makes the statement. He says, I have made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a virgin. He made a conscious choice. But what we will discover is that we do not live in isolation, but yet it has to start in the heart. It has to start with things like what Job said. That is not all there is, but that's where it must begin if we are going to be what God wants us to be. So are we immune to a lot of what we are seeing? One writer wrote several years ago, he put down these thoughts. He said, it is not uncommon for Christians today to argue their right to practice questionable conduct because they are strong and not affected by it. You ever heard that argument? People say, well, that doesn't bother me. I'm really not affected by it. So it doesn't apply to me. They can go into a bar, they say, and sit with those who are drinking and never be tempted. They can dance and never have lustful thoughts. Never have lustful thoughts. They can attend the raunchiest movies and not be affected by the profanity, the violence, and lasciviousness that's portrayed on the screen. They can listen to the most obscene music and pay no attention to the words. They can go to the beach and be surrounded by people who are almost entirely naked and not even notice. Not even notice. They can take all kinds of liberties with their hands on dates and experience no temptation to fornicate, so they say. Have we ever been there? So we look then at what does the Bible say? All right, look at men. Like Timothy, for instance. One of the things that is said about Timothy in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 20 is Paul says, I have no man like-minded, no one else like me than Timothy. Those were Paul's words about him. But then in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 22, what Paul says to this man who he says is like-minded, that I have no one else like him, he says, flee youthful lust. The clear implication is that Timothy would struggle with some of this. Even people like Timothy, I have no one like-minded. In 2 Samuel 11 and in Nehemiah 13 in verse 26, we are told about the difficulties that David and Solomon had, all the wives that Solomon had, and how they turned his heart away from God, how David's heart was moved away from God by the fact that he observed Bathsheba bathing. And we know where that led. But these are men of God.
They were susceptible to it, just like we are susceptible to it. In Matthew chapter 16 and verse 23, even Jesus did not appreciate temptation coming from his disciples. He told them, he said, "You are a stumbling block to me." Those were Jesus' words. He said in Matthew 18, he said, if you cause one of these little ones to stumble, he said, then you're the stumbling block and you will pay the price. So think about what you're doing. And the effect is, even Paul, in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27, he's talked about buffeting his own body to bring it under subjection. He knew what the temptations were and what the difficulties were. He elaborates further in that in Romans chapter 7. But these are men. These are good men. Being tempted by sensual clothing is not so much a sign of spiritual immaturity as it is the reality of the power of temptation in our lives. The reality of the power of temptation. We need to recognize that. The very fact that Timothy was commanded to flee ought to tell us about the power that it has. As we've read from what Wendy Shallot says, the world sees it this way, that there is a need for this. In Luke chapter 16 and verse 8, Jesus noted, "For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light." They are more shrewd. They use all of this. They know how it affects us. And yet, we pay no attention. We just kind of go on and pretend that no one is tempting us and no one is saying this. It was noted back in the late 60s that the designer behind the miniskirt had purposely designed it in order to seduce a man. Newsweek magazine reported that. We should not be surprised if some modern designs have the same purpose. This means that even if a woman has no intention of seducing a man with a short skirt, she needs to understand that designers created this apparel for that very purpose. The attire was to lust. But we don't recognize that. We just go right on by and say, "Well, it doesn't affect me." Oh, really? You know, there's some areas in our lives that I think we have a difficulty being really honest with ourselves. I think in this area, the area of dating, relations with the opposite sex and how it might affect us and what we can do and what we can't do. Pure motives do not cancel out the influence of provocative clothing. It will still do that. It will still entice. It will still move people to be what they shouldn't be. There was a flyer that was posted in a correctional center. And this was found in Monroe, Washington. This is what everyone had to look at before they went in to see a prisoner. And this is what it said. It said, "Clothing not allowed." And then it listed some. Low cut, exposing undergarments, cleavage, or the back. Sheer, transparent, or mesh fabrics, other than hosiery. Tight-fitting clothing, spandex, lycra, or other rubberized or elasticized. Clothing that refers to obscenity, alcohol, drugs, or sex in any form. Shorts, cutoffs, and halter tops. Do they know something that we don't know?
These are people in the world.
They knew. They knew exactly. And they warned people. It is true that while not all shorts are immodest, even the above non-Christians realize that many shorts can entice. When it comes to that which incites lust, the world is much more aware of its effect on us than we are. In Genesis chapter 20 and verse 9, if you remember the story about Abraham and Abimelech, he lied to Abimelech about Sarah. And Abimelech, when he found out that Sarah was his wife, he was incensed. What have you done? What are you causing me to do? You see, the world got it. In this instance, Abraham didn't. But Abimelech did. He understood. So what then about our influence in all this? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 31, Paul says, "Do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. Do all to the glory. Don't give offense, causing somebody to stumble." In 1 Corinthians 6, verses 19 through 20, "Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price. Glorify God in your body." Glorify God. That's what this is for. To glorify God. Not to glorify man, but to glorify God. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12, Peter says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Watch your behavior. Make sure it is right. In Luke chapter 17 and verse 1, "It is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to him through whom they come." Do I have a responsibility to make a covenant with my eyes and not to allow my eyes to wander? Yes, I sure do. I have that responsibility to do that. But so do you. To make sure that stumbling blocks do not come through us by what we wear, by what we say, but how we act. Now, does that mean we might have to go the extra mile? That we might have to wear things that we really don't want to wear because they're modest? And it might affect someone else? Yeah, that's what it means. Do you want to be responsible for causing somebody to stumble? I really don't think any of us do. I think sometimes we don't realize the effect that it has. Peter also talks in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 2 about chaste behavior. The word chaste means pure from carnality, Vine says. Pure. In the area of clothing, a carnal or worldly attitude can be expressed by either overdressing, materialism, and Paul deals with that in 1 Timothy chapter 2, either or by underdressing, sensuality. Deals with both. Our attitude becomes very important in these areas, that we clearly understand that we are not to love the world or the things that are in the world, because all that is in the world is going to vanish away. Now let's explore some myths with regard to modesty. The first one is modesty is only concerned with our hearts. Not so. But I've heard that. People will say, "Well, God is only concerned with your heart." Oh, is He really? He's not concerned about how you act? He's not concerned about what you say, what you do, how you treat other people. How do you get that God is only concerned with my heart? It is true that He is. And it is true that the heart lays the groundwork
And it is true that it starts in the heart, but it doesn't end there.
Modesty, another myth. Modesty is legalism. Actually, the grace of God teaches us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in this present age. Titus 2 and verse 12.
Titus 2 and verse 12.
There's nothing legalistic about wanting to glorify God in our bodies and about not wanting to cause another to stumble because of a lack of clothing. Romans chapter 14 and verse 13 says this. It says, determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in your brother's way.
That's my responsibility.
Not to do that. Another myth is that modesty is Victorian. We don't have enough time to go through and explain exactly what Victorian is. Needless to say, it was a period in our world in which attitudes and dress seem to be a lot different. They seem to cover a lot more. Actually, the Bible teaches the need to be modest long before the Victorian era existed. Another myth is that modesty is no exposed ankles or what someone might call radical Islam, Islamic religion, the way that they dress and how fully clothed that they are. The women in the Bible at times were not, did not always wear something that was that extreme, if you excuse the use of that word. Another myth is that modesty is synonymous with prudery. And this was the point. I don't know how many of you ever read anything about a movie called Pleasantville, but the premise of it was that nobody in the 50s had fun or experienced love because of high moral standards.
They were saying something that was absolutely not true. Wendy Shallot notes, she says, in truth, modesty is nearly the opposite of prudery.
Paradoxically, prudish people have more in common with the promiscuous. The prudish and the promiscuous share a disposition against allowing themselves to be moved by others or to fall in love. Modesty, on the other hand, invites and protects the evocation of real love. Now, this is a person that is not a Christian. Modesty is not natural, we are told. Another myth.
Well, it seemed pretty natural to Adam and Eve when they figured out what was going on after they took of the forbidden fruit. It says they were naked and not ashamed. And then, after they ate of the forbidden fruit, what happened?
They saw things differently. They clothed themselves. And then God stepped in and He clothed them further,
or better than they did.
Modesty is only for women. That's not so. If you turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 4. It says that each one of you know how to possess himself of his own vessel in sanctification and honor. Each one of us, men and women, must know how to possess themselves. The question is, what you choose to wear in public, is that what you would like to be wearing when the Lord comes? Really? I really don't think, given some of the things that we wear, that I don't really think we want the Lord to come at that point. So, if going to the pool or the beach is okay, Would you want your boy, your son, to have pictures or posters of girls dressed the same way on his wall?
Is that what you would? How many of you, I don't want to show hands, would go in and rip them off the wall?
That's probably the reaction you would get. Would you want pictures of your daughter dressed in what she wears to the beach or at the pool on a boy's wall or desk? That's what our eyes do. Our eyes take pictures. Our memory is there. It's hard to forget what you see. And we need to remember that. But one question that we need to consider in all of this is that, fathers, you know, when you were a boy, what affected you? Times have not changed. It still affects men. We need to think seriously about what we are saying by our example or by what we are not saying that we should be saying. So I leave you with a couple of things. In a survey that was done of young men and women ranging in age from high school to the mid-20s, well over 1,200 young people took part in this survey. And this is the advice that boys give to girls that are a part of that. Said, no short skirts or shorts above the knee. It's a distraction. No low shirts, tops, or dresses. It makes our eyes wander. Tight clothing is bad. It shows too much. Dressing modestly tells us you're looking for the wrong kind of attention. Wearing inappropriate clothing causes men to sin. Inappropriate clothing makes minds wonder. Bathing suits are not modest. Women don't understand how visually stimulated men are. And then the girls to the boys, keep your shirt on. No crude language or behavior or cursing. Don't be high and mighty or arrogant. You are not the most important person in the world. Don't sag your pants. We don't want to see your underwear. Body hygiene, we like clean. Be respectful and not just on a date. No inappropriate jokes. Dress appropriately for the occasion. Be genuine. Have a good heart that doesn't want to call attention to yourself. And please, don't wear skinny jeans.
I'm just reporting what they reported. Don't kill the messenger.
But it ought to make us stop and think, right? About what we're, the kind of world in which we're living and how it affects our children. And it's tough.
I know. And Janet and I could tell you stories about our struggles with our children about that.
And I'm not talking to you from the standpoint that I think I've got all the answers.
I do know this, that we need to all strive to be holy in everything that we do.
Like as God, the one who called us is holy, be. That's where it starts, the being. Yourself, be holy yourselves also in all behavior. So it starts in the being and it ends up in the doing. And then he gives us a reason. Because it is written, you shall be holy for I am holy.
And when we talk to young people particularly about some of these things, I will always go back to holiness. Does the outfit that you have on depict holiness? Is that what it screams? Holiness.
That's what we should strive for. Holiness in what we think, holiness in what we see, holiness in what we wear. Because God is holy. So ask yourself the question. Does this outfit I have on, would there be a depiction of holiness? Is where I'm going, would that be a depiction of holiness? Is what I say, how I talk, is that holiness? Be holy. Our God is a God of holiness. He is a great God, a loving God, who has given us information that we need to navigate all of the difficulties that we come to in life, if we will but yield ourselves to His will and be holy as He is holy. But it all starts with an acknowledgement of the fact that I am a sinner and that I need help. But Jesus came to give me that help. He died for me and He died for you. And He has made it possible for us to have fellowship with Him and to be with Him into eternity. But it all starts not just with what I think, but it starts with action. Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Then He calls you to Him to be baptized in His name, recognizing the fact that you can't do it without Him, that you are a sinner, that I'm a sinner. But then He doesn't leave us there. He says when we become His child, then He will be there with us and we can ask Him to forgive us when we fall. Because we will. Not because we're human. That's not why we fall. Jesus was human. We fall because we make bad choices. We allow influences of the world to come in. We need to be allowing the influence of the Lord to come in to counterbalance what the world is trying to get us to do. If you need to respond to the gospel, won't you please come while we stand and sing?